Hi, everybody, and welcome to the November episode of AZ MCAST. This month, we want to honor the life and memory of Dr. Peter Rosen, who passed away earlier this month. He touched many lives, helped to found our specialty, and has more accolades than I can fit into our little podcast. And yet, for some reason, he took time out of his day to help with our little podcast over the past 6 years. He provided us with balance, perspective, off-color humor, and an appreciation and a love for emergency medicine. Many organizations will be showing their appreciation for what he's done, and this is our little way of saying thank you to Peter. Spending time interviewing the father of emergency medicine is a time I will always treasure. That kind of mentorship is what Peter was truly great at. During my residency, he would play tennis with the residents or take us out to dinner just to see how we were doing and to wax philosophically and amicably about the specialty that he loved. The fact that such a legend would take time to spend with residents in training is truly remarkable. He cared about the well-being of his patients and his colleagues, all with a healthy dose of reality and humor. And I would encourage you all to honor his legacy by being a mentor in kind. I hope that his wisdom and his love for emergency medicine will continue to inspire others for years to come. Of all of the very quotable lines from Peter, my favorite, and the one that best encompasses his passion for EM and for the people that he mentored, is how he signed every email. Love, Peter. Thank you, Peter, for your help and your encouragement.
With everything that we have at our disposal now, we have coming up MRIs that are going to be more readily available. We have RNA biosignatures that are going to start to identify exactly the virus or exactly the bacteria in 2 to 4 hours instead of waiting for cultures. I mean, there's a test for anything that you want if you're willing to wait long enough. But for us in the ER, what we've discussed is that you can't make all those decisions for every single person per se, and you have to use some risk stratification. So we were eager to hear your perspective on how you deal with diagnostic uncertainty in the emergency department, specifically where it relates to advanced imaging.
Well, I think we need to step back and look at the process of making decisions in the emergency department, because it's quite different from the inpatient service, be it internal medicine, pediatrics, or any of the surgical specialties. So how is it different and how does it affect our decision making? It's different because if you start looking for a specific disease, you're going to make trouble for yourself. And the reason that we get so anxious about having diagnostic certainty is because we haven't gone through the mental logic of emergency medicine decision making, and because you can't prove a negative. So what is the correct logic? The correct logic is to not look for a specific disease. Your first tasks in emergency medicine are to measure the degree of difficulty of the next dive, if you will. Well, how sick is this patient? Is the patient dying is the first question. There are only a finite small number of ways you die, maybe 4, okay? Is the patient on one of those pathways? And if the patient is, what do I have to do to get him off the pathway? Secondly, if the patient is not on a pathway to death, how sick is this patient? Is this a patient who looks and is probably so ill that they're going to require inpatient treatment? And then and only then can you start asking questions about how did they get here? Because the third most important question is, what's different today? What changed for this patient that made them come to the emergency department? It might be something as simple as time of day. A little illness in a child that's tolerable in the daytime becomes very scary at night, and added to having put up with it for many hours, can't tolerate it any longer. that's still useful information in terms of how much anxiety are you going to have about this patient if you don't know the precise diagnosis. So that's number one. Number two, we're looking for diagnostic certainty via a logic that is inherently flawed from commencement. And that is, we have to use Bayesian logic about medical decision making. And Bayesian logic is, if there's not a high prior probability of the disease that you're looking for in the population that in which you're looking for it, there is no biologic test that performs with accuracy, be it an imaging study, be it a laboratory study. You only get false positives and false negatives, along with true information, and it's very hard to set out, but in terms of diagnostic certainty, it prevents it. The second thing is, even if we can remember the logic of how accurate any single test is, what we forget is, what is the value of the evidence of the test? For example, one of our major problems is ischemic coronary syndrome. Now, 10 years ago, maybe 20 years ago, the problem wasn't ischemic coronary syndrome, it was heart attack. For some reason, the awareness of what was a heart attack hadn't been codified, and we were struggling with doing it accurately. I think that the biologic tests for heart attack have now become helpful because we have a high prior probability in the population we're studying. So that's no longer the right question. The right question is not, is this patient having a heart attack? Because that's an easy yes-no answer today. But the tough question is this patient having an ischemic coronary syndrome? And sub-question A, if the patient is, then what do I need to do for it? And that's what leads to the diagnostic uncertainty. If we're comfortable diagnostically that the patient is having an ischemic coronary syndrome, we're not comfortable without an institutional protocol of what to do for that entity. And it varies from institution to institution. Inside some institution, it varies from cardiologist to cardiologist or primary care physician. And so we end up not feeling exactly sure what to do for the patient and thinking that yet another test will help us. So we move from our standard workup of acute coronary syndrome to coronary CT angiogram. And what we forget is, even if we move to the cath lab and do a specific coronary angiogram, we still end up with diagnostic uncertainty because there's no good rules and certainly no good evidence for which is the culprit vessel. And what the emergency physician doesn't see is that many patients get vessels stented that don't need to because they have a positive imaging study. So is it a false positive? Well, not in the usual sense of false positive. It's false positive in the sense that we don't know how to look at an imaging study and say this is what the disease is that's causing the patient's symptomatology. It's kind of like looking at a pneumothorax on a plain chest x-ray study. We don't know what the degree of pneumothorax is, even though we tend to put a number to it. We don't know what the pathophysiology is, whether we're dealing with tension pneumothorax. And all of the indirect findings that imaging gives us doesn't answer that question. It's a clinical question that can't be answered by an image. I think we need to go back away from feeling that if I have an image that is read as an X, then I'm dealing with an X, and that's diagnostic certainty. Lastly, we fool ourselves because we concern ourselves with a disease that probably isn't there, but we don't want to miss. And then when we don't find it, we breathe a sigh of relief and we tell the patient, great, you don't have gallbladder disease. Well, the patient didn't think he had gallbladder disease in the first place and still wants to know why his stomach hurts. And often we overlook that because we now move back to the position that this patient looks okay to us and we're happy that we've reached diagnostic certainty about gallstones, and we forget there's a zillion other entities that could be the culprit. So I think what we really need to start teaching is not so much how do I get people to order fewer tests and fewer imaging studies, but what's the quality of the evidence that we're going to get from any individual test? How is it going to alter my management of this patient? And if I can't answer that question, do I need that evidence?
I tell the residents a fair amount that one of the things that they need to consider is reassurance is one of the main reasons people come to the ER. They just want to know everything's okay. And there are those patients where they're reassured because somebody dressed like a physician has told them good news, it's not dangerous. And that can be accomplished with a history and physical, and they feel fine and want to know when they can go. And then there's other patients that say, well, how do you know? You haven't even done any tests. And so their trust is not placed in you, it's placed in the test. Even though they don't realize it's your interpretation of the test or a radiologist's interpretation of the test that's actually going to determine it. They have this kind of belief in an all infallible test that's going to let them know yes or no. How much weight do you put in the patient's desire for a testing modality to help relieve their diagnostic uncertainty?
I've perhaps encountered less of that than the present generation because I practiced for a long time before we had the tests. And so I got used to communicating my opinion of disease to the patient more than what the tests showed. I have had patients who simply have to have a study. There's something magical about having endured some X-rays that they can't go without. And frankly, I don't have the energy to fight with them. I don't think it's worth it. There are limits that I can set for myself. If a patient asked me to do a brain transplant, I would have no problem telling him, no, I'm not going to do that because it's A, not possible, and B, it's a silly idea for what's wrong with you. But if a patient wants a CAT scan for a kidney stone, and I know they've got one, I don't mind getting one for them because it isn't going to alter what I do for the patient. And I think part of that solution is we want to be reassuring to patients, but at the same time, we want to tell them what's wrong. This is how long it's going to be wrong. This is what you have to do to get better. This is how long it's going to take you to get better. And this is what you look for if you're not getting better. And this is what you do if you don't get better. In other words, we need to redesign our discharge instructions so that they're useful and they're more like a set of post-op orders than they are like a set of legal cover my because I know I've made a diagnostic error. So I agree with you. I think reassurance is significant, and I think that every patient comes to the emergency department with fear. Every patient is afraid of some diagnosis that they think they're having. And part of our job is to find out what is that fear and try to alleviate it.
I'm always kind of shocked when I go into a room and I meet someone for the very first time and start asking them about 30 seconds worth of questions and very quickly go into, so, do you smoke? Do you drink alcohol? Any drug use at all? Do you have sex with men, women, or both? It's just the crazy questions that we can ask people having really never met them before. So how do you recommend that we go about establishing this rapport with patients so that they trust us to take medicine, to undergo painful procedures, to follow up as we direct them to when we just met them?
It somewhat depends on how sick the patient is. When patients are dying, they trust you. And their family trusts you because they want help and you're giving it. And that's all the relationship you need. It's the patient who's less sick that doesn't trust you right away. And then it becomes a matter of what kind of a doctor are you? How do you form a professional relationship with somebody? If you just come in, take a two-minute history, take a two-second physical exam and never see the patient again, of course they don't trust you. But how do you greet the patient? How do you interact with them? When they're not that sick, I always start by something non-medical. In Boston, it's always safe to talk about the Red Sox. Whether it's good or bad, you can always establish a relationship with a patient by talking about the Red Sox or the Patriots. So what is it in your particular geography? Talk about the weather, you talk about rattlesnakes, something. Make a joke. Do something to make the patient feel that you care about them and you are a human being who wants to take care of them. I think that a lot of it has to do with the psychology of how much time you spend with them. Because I have spinal stenosis, I don't stand up very comfortably. So I started sitting down when I take my history from patients. I don't spend 1 second longer with them, but simply the act of sitting down makes them think that I'm more interested in them and that I'm there with them longer. I always introduce myself to everybody in the room as well as to the patient. And if it's a younger patient, I usually start with the parents. But I also start with the child. I remember one of my favorite pediatricians, this guy I wrote many books with, called Roger Barkin. And Roger's a very tall, austere-looking man. And I remember I was visiting him one day at his hospital, and he got paged to the ICU for a kid who'd been admitted for, I think it was croup. And we went up there, and there was one of these typical scenes. The nurse was harassed. The mother was frantic. The kid was wailing. And it was one of these messy situations. And the mother started yelling at Roger, "Where have you been?" He had got the page 2 minutes before and couldn't possibly have answered it any quickly. He ignored her, and he went over to the child and said to the kid, "Give me a hug." And the kid put his arms around Roger, and the whole situation melted away. I was absolutely impressed. And it taught me a very good lesson, which is be a human being first, and a doctor second, and people will trust you.
That's really good. That's a good story, too. I've told some of the residents that, especially with parents, if the kid looks well, if your general gestalt is that the kid looks well, that 10 minutes sitting at bedside talking to them like a person will save you 3-4 hours of ED time and thousands of dollars worth of tests.
Yeah, if they think you know what you're talking about because you're a human being and you answer their questions and you really search out their fears. You can't just say to people, "What are you afraid of?" You got to find it out. And there is a fear. They're there not because the emergency department is an amusing place to come to. There are somatizers who believe that, but most people do not. And certainly most parents do not. And the father would probably rather be at home watching the football game, has gotten up to bring his kid in. They're afraid of something. What is it? Meningitis? Cancer? Who knows? Your job to find out. And you know the kid's not sick because he's destroying your exam.
So we hear a lot from different organizations, different podcasts, different emails that we get, ghost stories from our attendings about sticking to standard of care. We're also told that standard of care kind of changes depending on where you're at. So being that it's supposed to be standard, that's in the verbiage, who is it that actually sets standard of care? Is it our attendings? Is it our local legislature? Is it our colleges? Is it our professional organizations? Who is it that establishes this standard of care that we're helping?
Well, you've pushed one of my buttons. I hate guidelines because they aren't guidelines, they're mandates. They start out in good intent. The society says, I want to help my members to protect them from criticism in areas where it's not easy to manage patients, where there are lots of errors made, and if we can give them a safe practice that they can at least look at that practice and start from there, then they'll be more defensible. Instead of which, a group of guys sitting around a room, many of whom are very smart, many of whom are very experienced, and some of whom don't practice medicine anymore, come up with a set of rules that are all-encompassing, that don't fit any single patient, and really aren't useful guidelines. And you are free to ignore them. I don't think that you can define a standard of care. I think that doctors ought to stop worrying about a standard of care. It's a legal term. And whatever you think it is, they're going to think it's something else if it brings them money. And there's going to be a doctor who will come in and say, it is that other thing, because it brings him money. So forget about the standard of care. Think about, what is a safe practice? What do I need to do to make it safe for this patient? Can't be perfect. Without being perfect, how can I make it safe, make a minimum number of errors, and do what is necessary to make the patient feel better? Now, if guidelines help me to get started on a patient, then fine, use them. But don't rely on them as either protection or as a recipe for best care.
I've had the discussion with lots of people about how the other fields of commerce that we're people try to buttonhole us into of, well, emergency medicine should be more like airline pilots, or no, emergency doctors should be more like the hotel service industry or different kinds of industries. And I just can't think of a good patient population or a good customer population that represents emergency doctors the way that an auto mechanic would be. I think we're the closest to auto mechanics because you only go to the mechanic when something's wrong with your car. By the time you get there, it never is doing the thing that you were worried about it doing before, and you usually look fine. You have to make the noises you were making beforehand in order to explain it to them. You have generally little idea of what the mechanic is going to do. You have no idea how much it's going to cost, but you know that you're really upset that you're there. And I've tried to talk with some auto mechanics about this, and I've probably gotten better service on my car since then. But talking with them about it, it really is about getting people to trust you so that they trust your judgment, because there's no way you're going to give them a medical school education during the time they're in your ER.
I think the analogy to the airline pilot is an incorrect one. In regards to, it's not comparable to the everyday responsibility of an airline pilot. The analogy was more comparable to the pilot at a time when something has gone disastrously wrong on the plane, and they have to call upon their years of experience to outride the disaster. Not unlike that moment that happened to the pilot in New York City. There's no way you could prepare for something like that. He had something like 2 minutes to figure out how he was going to salvage the plane and its passengers. And that is much more comparable to what a physician does. But all of these checklists work for the performance of a machine that has to work in a certain way. But we have to recall that the physician is not such a machine. And the process of medical decision making is not robotic or computer analysis capable. It requires a human judgment. And the more we try to remove the human judgment, the worse job we do, the more errors we make, the more it costs to practice a lower quality of medicine.
Kind of going along the same vein, we're going to be talking about pediatric fever in one of the months coming up, and there's a lot that's come out recently about new modalities of trying to figure out why a neonate would have a fever. We're doing a study here to figure out if we can get a 2 to 4 hour turnaround time for an RNA biosignature to determine if a child has a bacteria, a virus, both, or neither, which would be great, and it would be pretty revolutionary for what we do for kids as long as it works. A lot of what's coming out is newer algorithms for how to determine who's high risk, who's low risk, and the algorithms have changed along with the epidemiology. But you alluded to this earlier about you can't stick to an algorithm if this, then this for every patient, because at some point you have to be a physician. So with an algorithmic approach to emergency medicine, where do you see us having to steer away from what the algorithm says versus, okay, there truly is new epidemiology and we can't practice like we used to before vaccines, so here's a new way to train your mind to approach these well-appearing febrile children?
I think the utility of the algorithms is to teach you the parameters to investigate, but they don't substitute for clinical judgment, because you have to use clinical judgment as to whether or not the child scores in the algorithm. And if you're going to do that, you probably don't need the algorithm. I'm very opposed to this attempt to make medicine into a mathematical proof. Mathematics is not the practice of medicine, and it works for mathematics. It does not work for disease. And I have seen more errors made from a blind adherence to an algorithm that probably shouldn't have been attempted to be applied in the first place, when it was quite clear from the clinical presentation that the patient didn't belong in that algorithm. I'll give you an example. I attended an M&M conference at another university a number of months ago, and they had a patient they were presenting who was one of those sad cases of ALS, who's gone beyond having any useful quality of life. This patient had been on a ventilator for almost 10 years. Couldn't talk, don't know how much communication she had with relatives, and was essentially living in a skilled nursing home on a ventilator. Now, someone in a nursing home, and it was never explained why, thought that the patient was having vaginal bleeding. This was some 57-year-old woman. So I sent her in for an evaluation of vaginal bleeding. A quick pelvic exam would have said there is no vaginal bleeding, and back to the nursing home. Instead of which, they put her in the vaginal bleeding protocol for an otherwise healthy woman. And they sent off a urine, which came back with a report that there were sperm in it. So then they introduced her into the rape algorithm. Now, I know that my gender isn't terribly concerned about who it will make love to, but there's no possible way that this woman could have been raped. Nevertheless, she started down this diagnostic pathway, and they kept finding things. And pretty soon she got admitted because she had an elevated white count, and she had something wrong with the urine, and I forget what other 19 things they found. And after 2 weeks in the hospital, she expensively died. It turns out that the sperm in the urine was a misinterpretation by a computer reading of the analysis. And that's what I mean by blindly finding algorithms is going to increase our error making and lower the quality of our care. It's not going to improve it. There's no substitute for a good, thoughtful physician.
It's a terrifying story.
It's true. I still can't believe it's true.
Having practiced medicine for a while, having started the specialty, having been around the block once or twice, it's got to be interesting having seen medicine progress. Things that you used to do that you don't do anymore. Things that you used to witness on a daily basis that no one that we teach now has even heard of or has even attempted. Things like diagnostic peritoneal lavage. Some of these things are going away. But it's got to be fascinating for you as well. How have you seen medicine progress over your lifetime and over your career?
I gave a talk last week in Boston about art and science and medicine, which I probably ought to give you some time. As I look at science in medicine, it's different from what we know science to be in other major fields like physics or chemistry. We don't have a body of theory that's based on falsified experiments. What we have instead in medicine is a science of problem solving. If we look back during my lifetime and what we can do as physicians, what we couldn't do 80 years ago, it's pretty remarkable. In my lifetime, we have antibiotics, we have blood transfusions, we have all kinds of surgical procedures that didn't even exist, but which in fact are quality and quantity of life-saving. We have treatment of diseases that we had no therapies for. We have extension of diseases that used to be instant killers. And I think that on the whole, we've done a tremendous job in medicine. Obviously, we've had our disappointments. And obviously, some of the things that looked like they were going to be very promising have not evolved, like the human genome. That was really exciting. We were going to define disease by genetic analysis, and that was going to enable us to fix things that we had neither therapy for nor prevention for. And it was a wonderful idea. The problem is, the more we study genetics, the more we realize that knowing the genome isn't enough. We have to know the epigenetics. I heard a really fascinating lecture here a couple of years ago put on by the science department of the University of Arizona. They have a science series lectures every year. And the epigenetics is just fantastic because we don't know really what is genetic and what is chemical stimulus of a change in a genetic capacity or enabling a gene to express something it wasn't before then. Like I learned in microbiology in medical school that E. coli could not grow in a lactose medium because it was unable to secrete an enzyme called beta-galactosidase. Theoretically didn't have the enzyme for it. But lo and behold, when you put the E. coli into a lactose medium, there would be a drop in numbers, and then all of a sudden it would rise again to normal. And what had happened was the E. coli that had no ability to express beta-galactosidase and developed one. Was that a new gene mutation, or was it just an expression of a gene that was already there, the epigenetics? And I think it's the latter. And we certainly have experienced something similar with antibiotic resistance. So the science of medicine is still mostly oriented towards problem solving. And because of a lot of sociology and politics, we're no longer capable of attacking problems like we once did. So I think our new knowledge is going to slow down, and our problems are not going to be solved in a way that they need to be. And I think that's a shame. But maybe the pendulum will swing back someday. But overall, to answer your question, I'm very excited about what medicine has accomplished in my lifetime, and particularly in my lifetime as a physician. Yeah, yeah. Well, you can tell everybody.